Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Peter with Real Estate Trends and Market Updates here. This is another episode with a guest, and this guest is going to be super beneficial for the people that are really wondering where they should buy, where they should invest, if they can get some nuggets out of those areas that they think may be a good area, but they don't know exactly how to get that data to confirm that. One tip that I want to say when we get into this is the data that you pull, the information that you pull about the area, the specifics of the area, how much income those people make, how the population growth is going, and everything else in between is very, very, very crucial to your success in real estate investing. And I think that that goes hand in hand for you as a real estate investor. And then also if you're looking for a new area and you think maybe you're too early in the game of that area, or you think maybe that area is too far gone. Maybe it's like in Austin, Texas, or, you know, San Francisco when it was right out of the gate and people were getting into it. This is going to give you that context to say, should I continue investing in this area? Should I start investing in this area? Should I do what I need to do in this area to be a multimillionaire in real estate and continue to build on my investing and investments that I have in this area to be more successful and double down? Or should I scale back and pull back my investments so I can actually say, hey, let's go look at another area so I can actually be that first person in that area because I can have the money to get into the area and then let it grow exponentially up. There's a shift in the United States, a big shift with a lot of people moving to different areas, a lot of companies moving to different areas. You want to be able to stay on the cutting edge and take advantage of these areas and make sure that you're not leaving money on the table. I think some people say, hey, I'm going to keep it old school. I'm going to keep it where we need to not be as mobile and stay put where we think it's always going to be. But I think that there's other places that are on the map, have been on the map for maybe a year, have been on the map for 2 years, but don't really, like, you're not getting a lot of pull from everybody else with people saying like, oh, you should go invest there, you should go invest here. This is the episode to really listen to twice and go through to see if it's actually your cup of tea to invest in this area. So Neil, he's been investing for quite some time. He sold his company for seven figures. He was a partner in that company, and then he went straight into investing because he thought that that was where his calling was. We talk a little bit about that. We talk that move from where he was at to where he is today, and we go through his expertise on kind of where the market's going, what he sees in the current market that he's invested in, how he got to that theory, and also to the endpoint of why he's going into certain markets and he's staying away from certain markets. So this is a very, very good podcast for you to take a listen to and then write down some notes, write down the data sources that he has, and make sure that you stay on top of each and every little nugget that he throws out there when he's talking on this podcast. And then we left his website on the notes page of the podcast, so you guys can go there. And then from there, I would definitely reach out to Neil whenever you get a chance and reach out to his company to make sure he could be another asset or be at least the person that can give you some more tangible information to go find that information for you to go invest in the areas that you want to invest in, that you've been looking at, that you've been maybe contemplating, but you haven't really gone 100% full tilt in. So thank you so much. If you guys can, leave us a rating and review wherever you guys listen. We'll check you guys after the show. Thanks. Hey, Neil, so much for taking time out today and chatting with us. Before we jump into, you know, the nuts and bolts of your business these days, can you tell all the listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. I am a technologist, so a nerd, a geek. I'm a data scientist. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area in Silicon Valley. So everything I do is really the application of technology. In this case, I'm applying it to real estate. Been doing it for a while, for about 14 years. The first 5 years, I did it just for myself to invest my proceeds from my technology company. And then after doing it for myself for 5 years and kind of going around the U.S. telling people about what I was up to, I finally started working with investors. Currently have a database of about 800 active investors that have invested with us. And the portfolio is about $1 billion, 31 projects.
Awesome. Awesome. And for you, before we get into a little bit more background for you getting into the space of real estate, you guys currently do mostly syndications?
Yes. So the vast majority of our portfolio syndications, we also sell fourplexes to investors. So that's not a syndication. It's not a partnership. We build fourplexes. They buy them. Right. So if somebody wants to buy a duplex or a fourplex and doesn't want to partner with anybody, they come to us and we build these large fourplex, duplex communities. That's a smaller portion of our business. So the larger portion of our business is either a value add syndication for an existing building or a new construction syndication where we build a building.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. What would you say, like for you, when you're doing technology and real estate investing, what got to the point and what pushed you over the edge that you said, hey, I'm going to go all in and start bringing in investors and everything else?
The realization that when I applied data science to technology, I made less money for less time. But when I applied data science to real estate, I made more money for a longer time. In technology, the window that you have to come up with something unusual and apply it, the advantage you have with others, it's fleeting. There's a million other guys in technology, both inside of the US and outside the US, that are smarter than you and faster than you and willing to work 18 hours a day. And so when I did something interesting in technology, I basically got 6 months to a year. And then I couldn't maintain that advantage. I had to invent a new advantage. So I was in this rat race where I was always running, and there were always people willing to work 18, 20 hours a day that were smarter than me that were catching up to me. When initially I started investing in real estate, I'm a data scientist, so I basically applied large data. So I started mining data from Zillow and 30 other websites, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and putting them into a statistical software. It's called R. And I would basically make various hypotheticals and see how the cities perform. So what I was trying to figure out is there a pattern, an algorithm, or a set of algorithms that informs real estate decisions? And I tried lots of different things. The place where the algorithms work very reliably was in city selection. So I learned when to select cities based on a set of data that I was putting in there. I call this location magic. It's very popular. About 50,000 people use this data set now. And so when I invented it, I invented it for me, right? So I was like, okay, I'm going to invent it. And based on this, I'm going to select some unknown cities and invest in them that nobody's ever heard of. The first city I invested in was Madera, California. And unlike most people, me being a data scientist, I didn't say, I'm going to go buy one property in Madera, California. My data showed me I had an enormous advantage. It was like gigantic. It was the size of Mount Everest. So I bought 10 properties in just one tiny town. And all of them were blockbuster successes. Every single one of them was a five bagger. So when I realized that, I was like, this was easier than I used to do in technology, because I'd have to assemble a 20-person team. And then, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So I was like, maybe this was just a one-off, right? Let's try again. And so I was like, well, yeah, but I just spent all of my cash on buying 10 properties. It's going to take me a while to gather cash. How do I play with other people's money? I don't want to take their money. I don't want to be their partner. But I want to basically take my algorithm, and actually I want other people to play with it and tell me what happened. So, you know, if it doesn't work, they'll just come beat me up. At least I won't lose $1 million. Yeah. So what I did was I opened a meetup group in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was late 2010, early 2011. And I went into this meetup group and I said, and, you know, the title, I think, for the first presentation was a data scientist's findings about real estate nuggets and jewels and things like that, right? And so I put this title together and I put it out in the meetup, and I'm like, you know, five people are going to show up because, you know, data scientist sounds really boring. But the lucky thing, Peter, was I was in Silicon Valley. Like, you know, geeks grow on trees here, right? So 25 geeks showed up, and a lot of them were rich. I mean, they were working for Apple and making $250,000 and working for Google. And I'm like, okay, so this is what I did. And they actually understood the jargon that I was speaking, statistical math and analysis and big data. they actually understood what I was saying. Eventually, when I started teaching to larger audiences, I had to really tone down the jargon. But initially, I was just saying the stuff and they were understanding all of it. I was like, this is what I did. And here's all the properties that I bought. And look, look, I'm making 37% on this one and 67% on that one. And la, 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 la. And they're like, so you want us to buy any of these? I'm like, no, I want you to buy them yourself. Here's a new list of cities, right? And so these people, yeah. they were lapping it up. They would go out and buy. And one guy from Apple, he bought $2 million worth 30 days after our meeting. Like he went out and bought it. And that $2 million turned into $12 million. So I was like, okay, you need to give me a 1-minute testimonial video. I just made you $10 million, right? So guy gives me a video. And so I take that video, I stick it in my presentation, and I present it again. Next time, 50 people show up. The time after that, 100 people show up. Then I get a phone call from somebody saying, I want you to present this thing at a conference 2,000 miles away. So I'm like, this is really lots of fun. I'm having lots and lots of fun with this. And again, I'm not thinking that there's a, I'm really dumb when it comes to, you know, these kinds of, should I be making money on this? I was like, this, I'm just so happy that other people are looking at this and making money. And I'm still making money. I'm buying more properties. Now my family's using it and they're buying more properties. So it's not like I'm not benefiting from it, but I'm not trying to benefit from other people's money. I'm just trying to get this message out there. And so more and more people start showing up and then they start improving the algorithm. Somebody comes along and says, you're missing this piece in the algorithm. You need to basically embed this. And I'm like, oh, you're right. So we go and basically improve the algorithm. And we keep doing more and more of this. And before I know it, you know, podcasts, I think I've done 200 now, you know, meetup groups, I think I've presented to 50, I've presented at 100 conferences. And so time went on, 2011, 2012, 2013. And every day people are telling me, we love what you're doing, but this math is hard to do. Why don't you just take my money? And I'm like, yeah, but I have this huge technology company and I'm in almost my final year of selling. I'm not going to give up tens of millions of dollars or millions of dollars of stock options that I had. The company sold for tens of millions, but I was a minor partner. And I'm not doing this. So I refuse to basically take anybody's money and be distracted. But on July 1st, 2013, I sold my tech company. And now I had two problems. One, I was in the absolute highest federal and tax bracket in the US, right? Yeah. And second, I had a lot of money that I needed to spend myself. So I'm like, okay, well, now it's high time. I mean, I have this list of thousands of people. They like what I send out. And so basically, I started to get into it. It took a while. I didn't really, you know, move into it quickly. So we went about the process. We bought a 7-plex and then a 412-plex. And then we sort of jumped to a 237-unit building and sort of developed from there. And today, I mean, what I like doing is, Peter, as I hired a bunch of people that do all the work. I just love continuing to talk about the use of data science. So now there's about 50, 60,000 people a year that watch them. I learned very quickly that if I make it very dense, people are not going to listen. So eventually I invented a 10-minute version of location magic. So I took the 57 parameters and picked the top five where you get the same result 95% of the time. And then I put it on a website called Udemy, udemy.com. There's about 10,000 people taking it, that course there. Then I put a new version of that course on my website, multifamilyu.com, and there's more tens of thousands of more that take that course there. And then I invented other courses similar to location magic. So I love doing that because it's more fun for me, and doing it as fun is more entertaining than the daily grind of sitting in multifamily meetings and my team does.
Yeah, well, you had a lot to unpack there, but it was, so I heard you speak back in, I think 2016, 2017 up in San Francisco. And it was intriguing for sure, because just like anybody that you talk to that's passionate about what they do, it doesn't matter if it's real estate or, you know, it's welding, you get a sense of confidence just out of hearing them speak. So it's the same for you, just like now, just like when I heard you in 2016. And the trajectory for you is built off enjoying what you do and being able to reap the benefits, the fruits of your labor, right? First, not really taking those fruits and allowing people to go out there and say, hey, do this, just basically model this and go out there and look at these markets and go invest. And people did that. And then ultimately, you know, you realized that at some point, hey, I can, after you sold your company, I can be profitable at this and take people's money to go invest. So that's huge. And I think that's one thing to take away from your story is being able to, you know, provide that value that ultimately sometimes you don't even see as the person that's developing it. Like you said, you didn't really see, there were certain things that you didn't really see. You just wanted other people to jump into those markets and be wealthy as well.
Well, I didn't actually believe that this algorithm would give me a lasting advantage in the real estate side. So, you know, I wasn't in real estate. I was just investing with other syndicators. I think I've invested 26 times with other syndicators. And I was like, these people must have some very complicated, you know, setups, just like my technology business did. And I found that actually they didn't. While a lot of them had great competence and experience at buying buildings and selling buildings and managing buildings, I found that their analytics were shallow because they weren't data scientists. So they were doing basic analytics and we were doing advanced analytics. So I ended up with an advantage. And what's interesting is I still continue to hold that advantage today. So when people come to, you know, Peter's show and say, you know, where are you investing? The typical answers that you'll hear are things like, you know, I'm investing in Texas and usually the top four metros in Texas. So you hear North Carolina, Utah, you know, Arizona, you know, and people say things like, I'm investing in Phoenix, right? Yeah. But Neil Bauer doesn't invest in Phoenix, but Neil Bauer will invest in, you'll hear me say things like, I'm investing in Avondale, which is within the Phoenix metro, but I'm very fascinated with Avondale's, you know, data demographics. I also like Mesa, but I wouldn't invest in Scottsdale. I wouldn't invest in Phoenix metro. I would just invest in those little pieces. Where I might say, I'm interested in the Atlanta metro, but in general, I'm not investing in Atlanta. But 30 to 40 miles away, there's a city called Fayetteville, and I really like its overall data profile. Or 90 miles away is this little town called Dalton, right? That's the way I invest. I'm fearless about investing in these tertiary metros because I've never had challenges with them because the data always put me there at the right time when demand was way higher than supply. And I was able to exit before supply grew. And a lot of smaller markets, supply is actually not an issue. Right now, there's tens of thousands of units being built in Dallas, right? But yeah. Where I'm investing is Killeen, which is 50 miles from Austin, barely builds 500 units a year. So it takes a very long time for supply to catch up with demand.
Yeah, that's very smart because people, like you just said, they hear one market and they jump into it. And by the time I hear it or by the time you hear it or something like that, even if you weren't doing all the data like you are now and you have been the past 15 years, 14 years, if you hear about the market, it's pretty much too late. You're getting in at a high price and you're getting in where people already flooded those areas. Granted, the last 2 years have been interesting, but even leading up to that, when I would hear about a market, it would already be passed by. Because there's so many people that are already in there. And even when I remember when you spoke, Phoenix was already blowing up. I mean, granted, since then, it's been transformed. But yeah.
Remember, back then, when I was doing this in 2016, there were people, you know, even in San Francisco were saying, yeah, but Phoenix crashed in 2008. Neil, you're taking a risk. And I would say, but this Phoenix's economy is transformed. It's not a one-legged horse anymore. Do you remember those kinds of arguments? Now everybody accepts them 6 years later. But back then, people were not looking at it the same way.
Yeah. I mean, if we're talking about Phoenix, you have multiple companies, large companies, billion-dollar companies that have moved into Phoenix that are now headquartered there. So,
yeah.
And that's kind of one of those things. I guess this would be a good transition to kind of talk to you about, like, what do you focus on outside of, you know, making sure you get into a market that's not completely flooded with a lot of supply, but what do you focus on? Maybe like a three-prong approach, or what's your approach when you're looking at the fundamentals in that market?
Okay. So one of the things is that I believe post-COVID, the best markets are the smallest ones. So that's a first place to start with, right? So I've never invested in Atlanta or Phoenix. I've never invested in these blockbuster markets, but I do invest in tertiaries around them. But now I'm also investing in tertiaries by themselves, meaning more than 100 miles away from a major market. So that's a core belief. Take it for what you will. It is considered more risky, so be aware of that. But once I go beyond that core belief, there's five things that I look at that I find to be the most beneficial. And we're tracking about 25 different factors, but these five are, I would say, the biggest five, right? So population growth, income growth, job growth, home price growth, and crime reduction. So once again, I'll go through that again. Population growth, job growth, home price growth, income growth, and crime reduction. Now, it's not just enough to look at these five things, but you have to know what time frames to look at. For example, job growth, whenever we look at two-year, five-year job growth, it means nothing. The only kind of job growth that matters is the last 12 months. So a city could have had phenomenal job growth 2 years ago, but if it doesn't have it today, there's not enough emotional, people are not feeling awesome. If a city has fabulous job growth in the last 12 months, everyone thinks that they're the kings of the world. Everyone thinks that only good things will happen to them because they're gods. And so they pay the most in rent, they pay the most for single family, they pay the most for multifamily. That emotional high is what we look for by looking at 12-month job growth. So, investing is a very emotional decision. I mean, most investments are made emotionally. So I'm constantly looking at emotional buttons that I can push, but I can use logic to find and measure those emotional buttons.
Which is really good. And I do agree, especially even when it comes down to investments versus, you know, your primary residence. I work with a lot of people that are buying and selling, and they are very emotional because they're moving into the home and they're going to be in the home 7 to 9 years. And then, you know, they're going to grow a family, right? But let's transition to buying as an investment. It's still a little emotional because you may get an emotional about
emotional.
Yeah, you get emotional about the area. You get emotional about, okay, well, hey, my friend Jim said that Austin's the best place to invest, so I'm going there. So I agree with you on that. When you're looking at breaking these down, population, job, home, and income growth, what are some factors that you see that you stay away? So as you talked about, you kind of look at job growth, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but job growth in the last 12 months. If you're looking at, let's say, population growth and income growth and then housing, what are those fundamentals when you look at those?
So first off, there are cutoffs. So I do not invest in markets where population growth is below 1% a year, right? So the US's population usually grew at 0.5 to 0.6% a year. Pre-COVID, it slowed drastically to about 0.2% a year. So my cutoff is markets that grow at a minimum of 1%. That's not actually a very high cutoff. That would still leave you about 20, 25, 30% of the US. What I prefer are markets that are growing at 2% a year. That's a high cutoff. That is my strong preference. It's not easy to find markets and submarkets that do that, but there are many. Like, for example, one of the markets I'm investing in, small market, is called New Braunfels. So that's Braunfels. It's a German town. It is sandwiched between the hottest city in the US, Austin, and a hot city, San Antonio. I also don't like investing in cities. I like investing in corridors. I find that those corridors get filled in if I stick around long enough. So there are five corridors that I love in the US. The one that I love the most is the 79 miles between San Antonio, a big, fast-growing city of 1.5 million people, and Austin, the fastest growing city in America, right? There are some people who might say, no, Neil, Phoenix is the fastest growing city in America. And the answer is, depends on your numbers. But if I had a list of top 10 ways to measure growth, Austin would probably be number one in six of them, and Phoenix would be number one in four of them. So it's slightly ahead by a nose, right? So they're both great cities to invest in. But I also know that they're both very expensive. So how do I invest in the Austin market without paying $400,000 a door? The answer is, I surround it. I'm a Roman general that basically is laying a siege around the city of Austin. And you'd be amazed at how detailed my siege is and how much I've had to plan. So imagine a city. It's called Austin. It's really expensive. I go and buy one property in there. So my investors know I put a flag in there. So I got one single property in Austin. Now I start my siege. To the north of Austin is the city of Killeen. It's 50 miles away from Austin, but it's only 38 miles away from all the affluent suburbs in the north of Austin, like Georgetown. Georgetown is rich. Rich places need poor people to come work there to make coffee for them and to clean up. Guess where those people live? Killeen. So I bought a property in Killeen. I told my investors I would rehab the property. Turned out to be a lie. I didn't have to rehab anything because there's so many people leaving Austin to go to Killeen that all I've been doing is raising rents. Takes so much work. I have to raise rents and then raise rents and then raise rents. I'm so busy doing that. So busy that I have the time to surround the city in other ways. To the west is Fredericksburg. 58 wineries, $10 million homes, amazing place. Rich Austinians and rich San Antonians and rich Dallasinians, I don't know if that's the word, they have to spend their money somewhere. And so they go out and buy their, you know, these beautiful places near Fredericksburg. And when rich people go out and buy $10 million properties, poor people have to go work there. So I'm building something in Fredericksburg. I couldn't buy something that was reasonable, so I'm building it. The city is very friendly. It's a small city. So instead of it taking a year to get, you know, all of my zoning and permitting done, I got it done in five months. So then I've now surrounded it from one side. Then on the other side of Austin, on the eastern side, is a tiny town called Manor. I'm working with a guy that is building 3,500 units in a development. I don't have that kind of money. So I'm taking a piece of that development from him. That's 200 units, working on it. Hopefully it works out. And then from the south, where all of the, where the corridor is, remember the corridor that's going to San Antonio is in the south? I'm just basically investing in every city. San Marcos, 210 units. New Braunfels, 110 units. And then San Antonio, five projects, 700 units. And you might say, why 700 units? The answer is, my data shows me this, that the secondary city that is closest to a red hot supernova is the most profitable. So I'll give you examples. West Palm Beach is more profitable than Miami. Colorado Springs is more profitable than Denver. Tucson's more profitable than Phoenix. I'm not saying that there's no money in Phoenix. That's a silly thing to say. But what I'm saying is that you end up paying so much in Phoenix that your overall profit margins may not be very good. You're investing in a great market, but it's not as profitable. But Tucson is the direct beneficiary of this amazing supernova called Phoenix. And so what I find is if there is this, a large city, and in this case, San Antonio is the only one, by the way, in my math that works this way, the secondary city is larger. So San Antonio is twice the size of Austin, but it doesn't have this incredible amount of tech migration that's coming from California that Austin's getting. The secondary city is the one where prices go up more because the secondary city comes off a lower base. If you look at prices in Austin, San Antonio is half that price, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't deserve to be half that price because it's a bigger city. It's the metro that's supplying manpower and logistics and industrials to Austin. And it's not very far away. You know, Sacramento blew up in terms of its prices because it's 125 miles away from the San Francisco Bay Area. San Antonio is only 79 miles away. That's unique. And so I think there's so much profit there. So like a general, I have surrounded the city of Austin.
I'm picking up all that you're saying is attack those smaller cities because that's where the blue collar workers and those are the ones that are there and high demand, right? Because, and as you were talking, I'm down south of you, so I'm in Orange County, and a lot of people have moved 35, 45 minutes away from Orange County because they'll come in Orange County and they'll spend the time in traffic because Orange County pays higher wages and they can get the income there, but they're willing to drive that 45, 50 minutes and longer in traffic. So, and these are the tertiary markets that you're seeing that are the same way, is people will drive that 35, 40 minutes, maybe 50 minutes.
50 minutes, right? So, I mean, my favorite down there for the last 5 years has been Riverside. I've been telling people OC is getting more expensive now. It's a good market. Go invest in OC because it's continuing to get a lot of people from Los Angeles. But if you want the highest margin, go another 15 or 20 minutes. Go to Riverside. You know, so San Bernardino County, that sort of, you know, concept. So I think you've latched on to what I was saying exactly. Yeah, that's the whole concept. Look at where blue collar people are being driven to.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that it's brilliant. Is there some markets that you would say, I mean, outside of hearing all that, are there markets that you're saying, hey, I was in them, I'm never going to touch them again?
Chicago. So I would say Chicago is, in my mind, the worst market in the United States. Then Pittsburgh might be a, you know, close second. So I hate saying this because I get flamed when I say it, but some cities are more corrupt than others. I have found, for example, Utah to have an extremely high level of competence and also an extremely high level of ethics. I unfortunately have not found that to be true in Chicago. Obviously, lots and lots of ethical people and beautiful people live in Chicago. It is one of the greatest cities in the world, not just in the US. But when you invest there, you're going to come across, because you're in buying a Class B or Class C properties, you're going to come across a lot of challenges. The sort of challenges I've faced there in terms of theft, in terms of incompetence from the city, incompetence, you know, ridiculous increases in taxation, doubling the price of water, doubling the price of gas and electricity, just because the city's, you know, pension fund is bankrupt. Those kinds of problems I like to stay away from. I tell people I'm a liberal Democrat that only invests in deep red states. Why? Because it's not my money. It's someone else's money, not my money. And I feel someone else's money is safer in those deep red states.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard, you know, two different things. I think things have changed. I know, you know, listening to Grant Cardone a long time ago, he was talking about investing in a lot of more blue states. But granted, the last couple of years, the last, I would say 5 years, for one, the landscape's changed. And two, making sure that you get, just like you talked about before, getting those 200 units done and quick, and make sure that, you know, the permit process and everything else is very streamlined. When you get into states like California and stuff like that, it takes a lot longer to get those permits done, which ultimately those holding costs go up extremely high. And it doesn't sit well, especially if the market changes and you have the investors' money tied up in that, or just debt tied up in that. So I agree with you on that, because it's very streamlined, and it's a lot longer. We're doing ADUs in about an hour east of my area. And it took us a little bit over a year just to get approval on one ADU recently. So we see that across the board, which it takes a little bit longer. So for you, what does it look like for, you know, I know that the landscape's changed a little bit the last 6 months, but that's more with the interest rate and also, you know, buying. What does it look like for you in the next year? Are you more conservative on underwriting deals and underwriting areas, or is it no holds barred, just gamebusters?
I think that I'm more conservative in terms of having spare cash, meaning I keep a higher level of reserves than I used to do before. And I keep a higher level of capital expenditure, or CapEx. But otherwise, I'm not underwriting more conservatively. As it happens, I'm paying less for buildings simply because debt is more expensive. So when you plug the debt into your spreadsheets, the amount that you can pay for a building is going to fall. And, you know, in my case, it's probably fallen between 10 and 15%. I'm investing in high growth markets that have a lot of supply demand issues. And so while they could take a, if we do end up in a severe recession, we are going to end up in a recession at this point, that's 100% chance, but it's going to be a shallow recession. And shallow recessions don't do much to dent rent growth. It drops a little bit, but it usually comes up within 6 or 7 months. And that's what I've seen in the last 60 years. I track that data. I'm obsessed with that data, by the way, in a slightly unhealthy way. But when I look at that, I don't really see a reason for me to change my rent trending. Obviously, and I don't see a reason to change my cap rates, because if the cap rates were high, I would just wait a year. If they were still high, I would wait another year. So I don't, you know, believe that there is any long-term change in cap rates that happened just because inflation spiked. Inflation spikes all the time. It's not a new phenomenon. We're just hearing more about it because the media latched onto it. So, you know, spikes up in inflation are extremely common. So bottom line is, the Fed is incredible at killing inflation. They've attempted 9 times and killed it 9 times in the last 61 years. They'll kill it because they have no upper cap. They just keep raising the rates until the economy slows and inflation dies. But they are horrible, absolutely horrifically bad at preventing a recession when they raise interest rates. They've only managed to do it once out of 9 tries. And that one time, inflation was at 4%. Today, it's at 9.1. So they put us into a recession. Nothing wrong with that. It's a good recession. I'm glad it's happening. This kind of forced recession is the one that doesn't damage the economy. If you don't go into a recession and inflation goes into double digits, it results in catastrophic damage to the economy, because every bubble out there bursts, right? Yeah. So what the Fed's doing is awesome. It's great for my business. It's great for my investors. And it's great for the economy. So to me, all that's happened is, because debt is high, I'm underwriting cautiously. I have more CapEx money and more reserves. Nothing else has changed.
I agree with you. I definitely agree. You know, we're getting into a recession, and also it's good for the economy, especially, you know, where it's at. What resources do you use for data, especially when you're looking at a new market or looking at the consistent markets that you invest in?
So there's, you know, paid sources. So I'll mention them and then I'll give you some free ones. You know, CoStar and RealPage are paid sources. They are the professional sources. They have terrific data. I have deep connections there. So some of the data I get for free, some of the internal data that they use also I have access to. And then in terms of freemium or almost free resources, the one that I really like that helps me is Local Market Monitor. So it's about $1,000 a year for a syndicator like us. I think that's great. They gather a lot of data. Housing Alerts is about $1,000 a year. Both of these track single family market trends. But I can tell you the multifamily market trails the single family market by 12 to 18 months. So if something changes in a particular city for single family, it'll change for multifamily 12 to 18 months later. So it's best to, you know, and if it's changing negatively, it's best to get out of Dodge. So we have this nice 12 to 18 month crystal ball. In terms of free data, there's nothing like the Yardi Matrix monthly newsletter. I consume it. I read it twice. I send, you know, questions to my team. I make screenshots and use them in my presentation. I think it's an absolutely phenomenal newsletter. Marcus and Millichap, you know, subscribe to their drip. They send out data. Walker Dunlop sends out great newsletters and also does great webinars. I just am a voracious consumer of other people's data. I don't believe anyone, but if four or five data sources are saying the same thing, then usually it's correct.
Okay. And what would you say, like on an average, this is more personal, on an average day, do you spend an hour doing data research, 5 hours, 30 minutes? What does your day consist of? Or do you wait the whole week and you're doing work and then on the weekends you spend that time?
No, I do my data research first thing in the morning. 8 o'clock is my call with my executive assistants. So before they call, I have spent an hour reading. And so that's when it's fresh in my mind. My mind's fresh of, you know, so I've got my coffee cup and I'm just reading for an hour. And they schedule stuff for me. If I need to watch a webinar that I missed, they schedule it at that point in my calendar. So I just tap the link and I watch it. I do watch everything on 2x. So at double the speed. And that sometimes means that I don't catch all of it, but I'm able to consume a very large amount of data.
Gotcha. Okay. And what would you say so you talk about this 9 times with the feds being able to tamper inflation. I think that's what you said. Where is that type of data? Is it in the same links or the same resources that you mentioned here, or is that somewhere else? Or is it?
That's just Google searches, right? So you basically say Federal Reserve track record in killing inflation. And then you go to Google Images. I think what most people tend to miss is they'll search for something on Google. And I do that just like everybody else. But very often I'll switch to the Images tab, and that's where the graphics are. So there's, if you type in Federal Reserve interest rate hikes over time, and then click on Google Images, so that little Images button on the top, now you will see the Federal Reserve's track record. And you'll notice that they've raised interest rates 9 times since 1961. So you see all the charts and you notice that they raise interest rates sharply, but then they never wait at the top. They drop interest rates sharply as well. And so that's why I tell people with great confidence that people who are thinking that interest rates will stay up 2 or 3 years have never looked at the past data. Show me one instance in the last 61 years where the Fed raises rates sharply and then does nothing. Because the Fed, their job is to gut punch the U.S. economy and bring it to its knees, basically bring the economy to a zero velocity, right? So if GDP is 3%, they want to bring it to zero because that is what is needed to kill inflation. But they don't want to make it go to -1. So what does the Fed do once they are at zero? They pick up the economy. They bought it to its knees. They pick it back up. And how does the Fed pick it up? By cutting interest rates.
Yeah.
There are no plateaus.
No. No, it's hills and a lot of hills going up.
Sharp hills, right? Sharp hill, sharp up, sharp down. Again and again, 9 times in 61 years. They've only failed to kill inflation once, but they did a bang-up job of fixing their error. So they raised rates in 1982. Inflation went down. They very quickly cut rates, and they cut rates too soon. Inflation went back up. They realized their mistake, turned around in 3 months, raised interest rates again. 6 months later, they had killed inflation. And that inflation actually didn't go back up for 15 years. So they did a very good job.
So you having this data and stuff like that, what did it look like back then in 82? Because if you hear some economists speak, and I know you've done a lot of homework on this, but what did that look like for the economy when that came up with the inflation was, you know, the highest it was until now? What did it look like there on the recovery?
I love getting this question, right? Because it's so eye-opening, right? So our interest rates today are at 5.3%. The 30-year mortgage rate is at 5.3%. In 1982, mortgage rates were at 18.5%. We're whining about our rates going from 3 to 5.3 and thinking that this is the end of the world. Imagine them going from 5 to 18.5. You might say, that was the end of the housing market. Why would anybody in their right mind buy a home? Homes must have crashed 50%. So here's what the data tells us. Homes went down 10% for 3 months, up 10% for the following 3 months, and ended a 9-month recession higher than they started the recession. So we went through a recession and it was a pretty bad one because the Fed had to basically do it twice. So sharp up, sharp down, sharp up again, sharp down. And by the end of the recession, home prices were higher in the US. So home prices are very resilient because it's an emotional decision. They don't drop very easily. Now, obviously, home prices are much higher now. The prices have been going up for a long time. So I do expect them to drop 5%, 10%. I think these are all reasonable numbers. Once again, corrections are good. They prevent bubbles from bursting. It's good. But if you think that home prices are going to go down 20% because interest rates are at 5.3, just study the last 10 years. Look at how many times interest rates went to 5.3. Try to find a time, any time, when home prices dropped. Yeah. It's not unusual for rates to hit 5.3%.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're ringing the same bell as a lot of people that I listen to. You get some that say the opposite, saying that we're going to 11, 12% interest rates and the market's going down. But I agree with you. There's fundamentals that have been involved. And also there's a lot of things that the feds know that, you know, they see and they make sure that they do it cautiously and they fight inflation properly. And, you know, what really helps in an inflationary market is buying more real estate, obviously cautiously and having the reserves, like you said. So those are the things that I think, and also the inventory. We didn't really talk about it, but the inventory that we sit on today versus going into 2008, just in Southern California alone is 5 times less now than it was.
Yeah, there's nothing. Where's the inventory, right? It's going to take, and by the way, people are like, yes, but as the recession starts, the inventory will rise. Again, study the past. Housing is resilient even in recessions. It is actually, we're at 1/5 the inventory. Just to get to double what we have today, which would still be 40% of what we've had in the past, it takes a good year. It takes an entire year to get inventory to double of where it is today. It just doesn't magically appear all of a sudden, right? So the concepts that people have, they don't study the past. And especially what I find amazing is people don't even study the last 10 years, let alone the last 30 or 40 years, right? So I think these are critical things. I mean, today's real estate is driven by macroeconomics. Real estate before 2002 was not really driven by macroeconomics as much, you know, unless you were in 1982 and then, of course, you were affected. But most of the time, it was just a separate market. It had its own demand and supply. Today, real estate is really driven by what the Fed does. So watch what they do very carefully. I don't give a damn who is the president, which party is in power, but I care about every word that the Fed chairman says because the Fed chairman is the most powerful person in America.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, before we get you out of here, I'm going to transition. This has been, for one, enlightening and also, you know, reinforces a lot of thoughts that I thought, especially on the economy and the current economy. Neil, for you guys, what are you guys using that has helped your business grow? And this is an online resource or platform or app that you guys are using in your business now that's really helped you guys be efficient.
It's a very, very easy answer. To me, the most magical website in the world for most businesses is called Upwork. Upwork.com. Upwork is like Amazon, where Amazon has these amazing reviews. Everyone knows that they should buy things with 4-star reviews. Well, do you know that you can get 5-star reviews on people on Upwork? So we hire people in the US from Upwork. We hire people in Canada. We love Canadians. They've They're like Americans, but more polite and slightly cheaper. So get 20% discounts. And then we have an army of people from the Philippines. So, and we hire people from all over the US. For example, this morning, I hired a person on Upwork. He's an American. I paid him $150. And he took one of my presentations. It's 45 minutes long. And he's adding humor. He's a comedy writer. And he's really good at it because I read 30 five-star reviews. So he's taking a completed presentation that's completely written that I've already presented, and I'm sending it to him and saying, please inject this with humor. Because what happens often is I'm funny when I'm in person, but I find that when I'm doing PowerPoint on Zoom, I tend to be dry.
Yeah.
Right? So that gives you an example of the kind of amazing talent that is available on Upwork.
For sure.
Obviously, you know, most of the time when we use Upwork, we're, you know, hiring people, I have an army of virtual assistants. We're hiring, you know, everything from underwriters there to, you know, people that are doing code, all kinds of things. It's just astonishing. That resource is absolutely phenomenal and ridiculously underused, right? Nowhere else in the world can you get reviews on employees.
No, I agree. I've hired 15 people, from VAs to people that did website design to people that did SEO, all the other stuff. So I agree. I just hired someone the other day. So Upwork's
a by the way, we have a 15-step Upwork hiring system on our website called multifamilyu.com. So go in there. It's about basically how to use 10x your business using virtual assistants. It talks about the US piece as well. We hire a lot more people in the US today from Upwork than we do from the Philippines. But it's a step-by-step system with graphs and charts and metrics on how to hire the best in the world.
Okay, cool. I'll check that out. That's huge. What about a book that you suggest or something you've read that's really changed your perspective?
That one's also very easy. So I'm pretty sure it's not the best book in the world for most people, but it helps you find the best book. It's The Miracle Morning. All you have to do is read the book and follow The Miracle Morning for 6 months. And I guarantee you will find your best book, because everyone's best book is really different. But The Miracle Morning is a means to an end. If you're thinking there's one book for me, one magical book that one day I'll read and it'll change my life, this book will help you find it.
Yeah, I agree. That one's huge. It helps out give someone structure if they don't have structure in their morning. For
yes,
sure.
Absolutely. And I think the reading part of that is the most critical.
Yeah. Well, Neil, right before we get out of here, how can people find out about you? I know you have a newsletter. Speak a little bit about that and then anything else you want to chat about.
Sure. So the easiest way to do research on me is simply to type my first name and last name into the web. I happen to be the only Neil Bawa in the world that I know of. N-E-A-L, by the way, not a coincidence. I made it that way. N-E-A-L-B-A-W-A. So Neil Bawa. Hit enter. If you're interested in podcasts, just add the word podcast. If you're interested in virtual assistants, add that in. If you're interested in investing, go to growcapitus.com. That's GROCAPITUS.com. As I mentioned, about 800 investors. We're making about 36% IRR on our seven exits. I expect to do slightly better in the future, given the unusual circumstances we find ourselves in. But the place that most people should start is called multifamilyu.com. Multifamily University, that's multifamily followed by the letter u.com. We store our last 20 webinars there. Some of them are from superstar people that you'll recognize in the industry that are friends of mine. A lot of the webinars are ours. They're data-driven, they're entertaining, and about 30,000 people a year watch these webinars. That's a great place to get started with our community and to engage.
Yeah, no, that's huge. I'll put those all in the show notes so we can definitely have a chat where people can go and ultimately connect with you. So, Neil, this has been enlightening, and it's been good to dig into what you look at and what you look at for your investors when you're going out and taking down those deals. So I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
All right, Neil, have a good day. All right, that was our episode with Neil. Like I said, he gives us a lot of information to make sure that we're on top of the game. We're making sure that we're finding those areas that are going to cash flow. And he also talks about how he jumped into a real estate market, got into 10 rentals, and he really got in
before anybody else did. And that's kind of where he took that model and then said, hey, I'm going to go ahead and be this person that's going to help out other people for free and then let them dive into their own markets and make sure that those own markets are making sense to them before they actually dive in. Just here's the information. You go do with it as you please. And that's huge because a lot of people think investing when you get in there is I'm going to hold all the information to myself. I'm not going to give it to anybody else. And I'm going to hold that in. So Neil talks about how he gave that information to other people. People said, hey, we'll pay you for it. He said, no, it's free. Just take it and go be successful in your own niche. And then he finally realized like, hey, I should probably eventually, you know, utilize this for business to be more successful in helping investors. And that's what he did. So like I said, his university or slash educational website is in the podcast notes. So take a look at that, hit that link and go visit Neil's website. You can invest with him. You can get as much information off that website to help you go invest on your own. And you can reach out to Neil too through the website. And he is a very personable person, just like we heard on the podcast. So you can reach out to him anytime and have that discussion with him. At least something that would maybe give you more confidence to go invest in your current market or that market that you're looking at. So thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe and also leave a rating and review wherever you guys listen. We'll check you guys next week with another guest.